This is a Niche Radio podcast. For more, visit www.nicheradio.co.za.
Okay, so I'm going to start off by saying welcome to my podcast. Welcome to the Come Join Us podcast. I've got Lawrence van der Westhuizen, who's actually chatting with us this afternoon. And it's always a first for everything, and Lawrence has always been our first, because we started our first Come Wine with Us about 7 years ago with Lawrence's beautiful wines from Arendsig. And we had it around a kitchen table, and this evening we're doing our first podcast, which we're also doing around a beautiful table at the beautiful premises of Arendsig, an estate on the Bonnievale Road. No, it's not Bonnievale, it's, what do you call this road?
R317,
Storms Flay Road.
It's close to Bonnievale.
Okay, pretty much Bonnievale, nearly there, yeah. So today for us is just about learning to know a little bit about the brand. So you've done a few events for us. I think we had one, obviously the first one I did at my own, and then you came to us last year as well pretty much in Joburg. We did it with Sophisticated Chef. And now the idea is we just want to chat about what's happening and what's been happening with Arendsig, and learning a little bit about you behind the scenes and so forth as well. I know you're a fond rider on your bike and a fond athlete, I would say, as well. So tell us, how did you get involved in wine? I mean, I know it's pretty much a wine region and Robertson's known for it, but what really stimulated you to get involved with it?
Well, it's, I think first of all, I'm the fifth generation on farm. So yeah. Farming always been part of what I've, my whole life was about. I mean, when I was young, I remember my dad always used to take me on the tractor, whiffing to the vineyards and stuff. So yeah, we pretty much been cooperative farmers all the years. And throughout in high school, we were quite naughty. I remember on a young age, we started getting into my dad's wine collection.
Where the other guys
will drink beer, we'll select some wine for us. And it just got better when I went to study.
With time.
Exactly. And I guess just I always loved vineyards and the wine side. And obviously, I went to Elsenburg, and afterwards, went to Glencarlo, did some practicals there. And I'm like, seeing that, the winemaking isn't actually that difficult.
Yeah.
So after that, I went to America, did some practicals there. I visited Burgundy as well. And in farming these days, obviously, you have to add value. And so instead of just becoming a farmer, I decided I'm going to make a couple of barrels of wine. And ever since, that was what I wanted to do. So
always.
Yes.
I can remember when you just got into it. I remember because obviously I was in Robertson with Lawrence as well at school, and he was my matric, so that means he was my senior pretty much. And he went out of it, and then he went to study. And then at one point, I walked into you somewhere, and then you just started talking about wine, and I loved it. I'm like, geez, he is absolutely into this now, and it's fantastic. I mean, you're living your passion pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in of it, I mean, it's more, it's something that happened to be my passion. So
yeah, totally. Yeah, cool. That's awesome. And tell me, pretty much living here, what would you say is the perks of this valley? What do you love about the Robertson Valley?
Well, the fact that I think it's mostly generation farming, so the place is pretty quite authentic, I would say. Everyone knows each other. You can always knock on your neighbor's door or ask questions to whoever you want.
Do you find a supportive
anything.
Area
yes,
as well?
Yes, exactly. And that is what makes this place special.
Mm.
Yeah, like I said, the authenticness of Robertson.
Mm.
And there's always, especially with the younger generation coming into the valley, I mean, the valley have changed quite a bit the last 10 years.
Mm.
Looking at, being quite a bog-producing area, there's a lot of great bottled wines produced lately. So, it's all exciting.
Awesome. And the whole stigma, or pretty much, I know Robertson, most people, when they think of Robertson, it's Chardonnay Valley. That's how it normally is. But you breaking the mold. You are doing a little bit different types of varieties. And I know you've got your inspirational batch. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so when I started out making wine. Obviously, I started out just with a couple of barrels. Firstly, I always liked Shiraz and Chardonnay. But as I started making wine, and also I started working various producers in the valley, one thing I started realizing is that this area is amazingly diverse. I mean, you just on our farm alone, up beyond the slopes, you've got rocky, shaly soils. We make wines of a lot of minerality and finesse, and then you go down literally like 100 meters down the slope and you'll find more calcareous clay soils. It makes more bigger, rounded wines. Mm. And then you've got your high production soils like the alluvial ones next to the river. So, I mean, that's just in a small space. And when I started going around in the valley, I actually came across various other type of soils and just started realizing how diverse this valley is when it comes to soil, your climatical pockets. And it's just...
Can I ask sort of how many different soils is here, you would say?
Yes, that's a difficult one, because if you really go scientifically and technically, it's like, I can look it up for you, we've got it, but it's definitely more than 50 different soil types.
That's insane.
But I mean, yeah, obviously the main soils like clay, your loamy soil, sandy soils, alluvial, everything's basically here.
How do you pair wines up, like varieties with soil? How do you do that? What is your sort of basic? I know it can get super technical.
Yeah, I do.
But if in a nutshell, if you would look at a soil, how would you pair it up with a variety?
Well, I would say I'm experiencing it is basically you can produce in with the climatical conditions we've got. I mean, we've got cool night temperatures, warm day temperatures. So the climate leads to that we can basically produce anything here. But a Chardonnay in shaly soil will taste different. Like I said, it will have more finesse and elegance versus a Chardonnay block in clay soil, where it will be more structured, more rich in color.
So it's sort of balanced.
More round. So then you sit with a different style of Chardonnay.
Yes.
And I mean, you can't say the one is better than the other one. It depends what
styles,
the preference of the customer is.
Mm.
So it's something we'll probably... That's the exciting part. That's probably why I started the Inspirational Batch range, is to showcase the diversity in the Robertson Wine Valley and the different pockets and sites, and grafting unique wines from various little blocks that I can actually find. I mean, for instance, where I do the Grenache from, it's a site close to Langeberg Mountains, and we sit with the Karoo soils. They're normally high in salts, and you sit with pH levels of 6.5 to 7, and soils that you always have to make sure you get kind of the salt out of it. But like I remember one winemaker once told me, do you ever braai your chops without salt or eat them without salt on them? So I guess it adds to something. But then where that site is, for instance, you sit with very high acidic soils. Soils that's got a pH of 5.5.
Good or bad?
And you have to do something, you have to think completely differently again when you make the wine. And on that site, it happened to be that it's mainly Rhone varietals, and they all come out, normally it works beautifully. I mean, the Grenache, natural acidity, that's just amazing. The same with the Shiraz. But yeah, it would have been, I know Carl Uwe at Vrijzig on that side also produces a stunning Merlot. So that's why these things become so complicated. That's why I can't really answer your question that white wine will work in, because I'm getting so confused. I mean, we've made last season 37 different single vineyard wines.
That's insane.
And that was in one season. And a lot of, I mean, you're looking at Viognier, Chardonnay, Shiraz, Grenache, Mourvèdre.
Yeah.
Bordeaux varietals like Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, various sites of Sauvignon Blanc, even Pinot Noir. So, you know, and you make these wines and they all, if the vineyard is in balance and you basically know when to select those specific grapes at optimal ripeness from that specific site,
yes, yes.
Then you can make a great wine. It doesn't need to be, I mean, but on that same site, let's say where the Pinots, maybe you could have had Chardonnay.
Yes.
If you knew exactly, okay, from that shaley soil, don't pick this stuff at 25, pick it at 22.5. Mm. That would have also probably worked.
So that really gets technical at the end of the day.
I mean,
day,
what right? I normally do is with my white varietals, I'm like, with reds, it's a bit different because... with red wine, you don't want to select like various picks. I want to get as close as possible to that optimal selection. So we'll do like in one or two selections, we'll pick it out. With the white varietals, let's say shaley soil, we'll pick a little bit riper than in the clay soils because naturally I get a bit more finesse and that almost acidity on the mid palate. So we'll do a pick at like 21.5, but on the clay soil where I need a little bit more acidity, where you get more roundness, you'll pick already at 19.5. So just to balance that out, so you can, by knowing the soil and the site, you can actually kind of manipulate your pick so it's still, the wine is an end of the day balance and a nice wine. So
that's amazing, actually.
So you can, and with Shiraz, I'm looking at red wines in the area that I think is something... that I've seen late, or the past three, it took me probably 12 vintages to figure it out. I always harvested reds in this area. I thought, oh, they must be super ripe, like a 25 Brix or 24.5. But the past three seasons, I started thinking completely differently, and that's to do probably with a Grenache vintage that happened to be selected at 22 Brix. And I thought, oh, it's what a stuff up. And eventually the wine turned out beautifully, and I started picking my Bordeaux varietals, even my Shirazes, at more like 23 Brix. So it's almost 2 Brix lower than what I used to do. And the wines, they're just so much more, they're more exciting. They've got more red fruit, there's more spiciness in the wine. And yeah, I think that's just how you start learning your area and your specific sites where you're making your wines from.
I know, obviously, everyone knows about the Western Cape had a massive drought. And I know that last year was really good. I know that most people that I spoke to with had really good harvest and so forth. But this year, some people were really battling, especially red wines, I know, or red grapes specifically. Did you find it? Did you see something like that? There's a bit of a change because of 1 year later with the drought?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say what the drought did to us, being an area where we do have enough water, but it was, in our instance, we haven't had good quality water. They were very high in almost salt content, you can say, and that doesn't work really very well with Karoo soil. So it was fine within the season when it was dry for us. We still had water because we can add some from the Bread River. But it had a very negative effect on the season after, like in this season, 2019. I could really see the vineyard struggling. And the best thing that could have happened was the 97 mils of rain that we had within 2 days this season. Just
that was
after.
Insane, I know.
And you could see the vineyards of, you know, they're kind of giving new growth again.
Yeah.
And they're happy. So... yeah, I guess it's definitely had production-wise also a big impact.
Volume,
I mean,
that
you
it
can
normally
see.
Goes.
But then again, then at least it gives us the opportunity to put our price points up.
So. Talking about price points, actually, what would you say was wine markets at the moment? Is people drinking more wine, less wine? What are they doing? What is, in your perspective, what do you think? What's happening?
Well, I definitely think people are more getting into wine, and especially seeing a lot of wine bars opening up,
totally,
people coming off to work, having a glass of wine. It's kind of as if there's a, hopefully we're finally starting to get like a culture of people that wants to drink wine and enjoy it. I mean, looking at the beer scene, that came, the craft beer scene, and it's as if, I'm just looking at our group of friends, we're drinking less craft beers, we're back on the Castle Lights just for one or two, and then we're on to the wine.
Yeah.
But the odd whiskey and brandy is also not too bad afterwards. So, I mean, there's trends, but I see wine always being like, you know, especially in our group of friends, definitely.
The millennials, the key, pretty much.
Drinking... product. I mean, if you look at the generation before us, my parents and so on, I mean, they drank wine, but it wasn't like as we actually also quite picky in a way.
We're more quality controlled, I personally
like
think,
to,
if I look at it.
It's about quality and enjoying craft wine, something different. not just sticking to one brand in a way, you know, you like to experiment.
Yeah, totally.
And so definitely I think that's been positive for the wine market. Mm. But then also an insight, the new generation in winemaking is also people that likes to experiment. The Swartland.
They don't easily stick to one brand, 100%. Yeah, but, they like to experiment.
Yeah, but also if you look at winemakers stylistically, if you look at the Swartland, when they started the whole revolution, Swartland, for me, did fantastic for the industry because everyone started thinking more creative in a way. And gave the industry a little bit of a shake. And that's cool because if you go into a wine shop in Cape Town, like a Caroline's or a Wine Concepts, I mean, it's very hard to choose a bottle of wine because each wine's so artistically made. If you look at the bottle, the label, and there's some great varietals.
Especially the Swartland wines.
I've seen the most
interesting labels and things of that time.
Yeah, but then again, the rest in the market followed.
Yes.
And what is exciting also to see is stylistically, it's as if if you look at the alcohol levels on the back labels of the wines, they're all like 13.5, 12.5.
That's high.
So it's actually for me where we've always used to be, like 14.5, 15%.
Oh, okay.
So we happen to, I think as an industry, we followed the new world way in winemaking.
Okay.
But nowadays, it's as if we're going more back to old way of wine or more old world. But South Africa, I can see, is finding their own thumbprint in between the two styles.
Okay.
And we're starting to really get into our own identity and crafting something unique that's exciting for the people, outside that needs to experiment with South African wines.
Fantastic.
So,
but talking about experimenting, so exporting, okay. So you export how much, if I may ask?
We export about probably 60% of our wine.
Mostly Europe, I presume, whereabouts?
Europe takes a fair amount, but I would say our biggest market, that's quite a new market as well, is actually America.
Okay, fantastic.
And then it's as if the past 2 years, the UK market also really came on board.
That's amazing. And mostly, if I may ask, what type of varieties are they looking at and what are they liking?
Yeah, that's always interesting because even in Europe, like in Switzerland versus Germany, they'll take different wines. And I think it's a lot to do with what import is bringing the wines in as well.
Course,
so you can't really take that as a, you know, because this guy's only taking...
It's probably because
of his taste and he'll bring that in. Always your main varietals like Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon will always
do well.
That's worldwide like that. But I see like the experimental wines like single varietal wines like Grenache, Mourvèdre, and even Pinotage see really going up a notch.
That's amazing, actually.
I think actually that's also because of the style. We're not making it that overripe anymore.
Yes.
Not too much wood, and that's what the European, that style of wine they actually like, more the elegant fruit-driven style.
Exactly.
So it's also a stylistic thing in a way, you know, and what you'll actually eventually sell into that specific market.
Do you think also the craftier type of styles that we've done, like you've been explaining that we're more into, is also helping the perception that we're not just bulk, bigger, better, and cheap wines? Because I know that sometimes when I speak to people overseas, they sometimes have a perception that our wine is cheap, you know what I'm saying, and the quality. But then I speak to other people again, and then they say, it is cheap, and then we actually realize what the quality of your wine is and what you get in return compared to other countries all over the world.
Looks about that, definitely. I mean, if you look at, I take myself, I've been making a wine since 2004. When I started for the first time marketing into Europe and so on, I mean, You'll see South African wines of unrecognized brands, you know, standing on the shelf for like a shocking price, very cheap, and it's obviously wasn't the greatest quality. So there was a very bad perception around South African wines, and that also kind of pulled down the price point.
Yes.
But the last 5 years, there's a lot of hard work being done via actually Warzone in a way as well, you know, giving the opportunity that we can go and show in Europe. And people have been starting to, we're all traveling more in trying to sell our product. So when you stand there with 20, 30 people, it's 20, 30 people knowing more about South African wine.
Totally.
And if you look at this, there's a lot of good quality wines, not necessarily per brand a lot of wine, but if you stand there and you market your wine, or you've got 1 million bottles or only 1,000 bottles, it's got the same impact because you're still talking to 30 people.
And totally.
As long as I mean, there's so, the quality level in South Africa is definitely amazing as late. I mean, it's just, it's like amazing. There's so many good wines. Like I said, it's difficult to choose a wine in a shop. Even your middle range wines is pretty decent. So, in that regard, you always will be known for your masses that you produce. In South Africa, unfortunately, we did produce only Plonk wines about 15, 20 years ago that we sent it over. But now there's so many little bits of wine going over that adds to quite a nice large volume.
Cool.
And a nice, with a nice... almost a quality image going out there.
Nice.
And definitely changing the perception. Because, I mean, for this first time last year, even my German importer admitted and said, okay, no, cool. They must say people are starting to talk about South African wine.
So, in
a way, I think it's a lot of hard work. Everyone's traveling. There's more exposure to what we produce.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Okay, let's get a bit off the wine topic. Or, basically, first we... Before we go with the wine topic, sorry, we're just going to press play here. Are we still going? Yeah. Okay. Show us your bottle here. I know we spoke about it earlier with regards to the waxing. Tell us a little bit about the waxing and how it works. Every single thing, by the way, is hand waxed and everything.
Yeah, so first of all, let's start with the label. You'll see I've got a wraparound label. The reason is when we started way back, I first just did it by hand, but it was always difficult to space your front label with your back label.
Okay.
So I thought to myself, let's get a wraparound label, then you can, as long as this is straight, then you don't have to space anything.
Yes, so that's quite clever.
Like one label that you put on. And later on, we got these little wooden machines that we started hand labeling them with, so that worked perfectly. Then for a long time, I used like just a normal capsule. But for me, it didn't. At one stage, 5 years ago, I really wanted to uplift the image again of the brand. So we started doing the waxing. And I happened to do a trial in 2012 on Cabernet Sauvignon,
mm-hmm.
where we did one palette without and one palette with the wax. And we kept that. And last year, we actually opened those wines, like a case of each, and we tasted. And it's just amazing... The how much better quality or the better, much more fruit the wine kept with the wax versus the one without.
That's amazing.
So the wine with the wax definitely kept much better.
Yes.
But the inside, it also depends what closure you're using inside the bottle.
I mean,
I'm not using an 8-9 rand cork because I had too many problems with cork where you get like corked wines and stuff. So I use the Diam cork that's... you're not going to have faults in the inside.
Mm.
But then again, the Diam 5, it's not the wine that's going to... It's meant to keep your wines for 5 years, but then I counter that with the wax. So in the end of the day, it balances out. So
okay.
You get almost two for the price of one, where you get the looks, but also seals the wine. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And you kind of, in a way, create jobs, because now...
Of course, you were telling
you have
me...
To and do those.
You're telling me you do 1,500 bottles on average. How many women does it?
They can, four ladies, but they can
four
possibly,
ladies,
yeah.
Okay.
That's if they're really going well in the middle of the week.
Not on a
Mondays and Fridays, they do half probably of that.
That's funny. And you were telling me about a machine as well, which they actually originally wanted to do with one of your clients. And it looked too perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was a bit of a problem. So we had to finish that whole 3,500 bottles that went out to the UK actually with the machine. Otherwise, my idea was just to do like one day's work. And eventually, actually, that machine, we ended up realizing it actually does the same amount of bottles.
Serious,
than what my ladies would do.
Yeah, all the jobs creation in the machine.
Well, they also have, obviously, but they send their own people on that machine. And I couldn't. We still waxed on the side.
Oh,
but
gosh.
you couldn't put the two together because that one was too perfect. So
It looked weird. And you've got a special wax for every single variety as well.
Yeah.
This one's got this variety, everything. You must actually bring us some more of your bottles if you can
see.
Yeah, I can. Have a look there.
So you can see, okay, I took four bottles out here. So the Viognier, I mean, this is quite a more heavier style that I ferment on the skins as well, like a orange wine kind of in a way, where we clarify the juice first and then put it back on the skins.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, it just tells me it must be like a yellow wax. Wax, it just suits the flavor profile of the wine.
Okay.
Where the Shannon in 2018... stylistically, it's also got these nice honey tones and almost like a honey cake you think of when you drink this wine. And that's why I use the orange for it. And these two, the Pinotage, it's two separate vineyards. This is from shaley soil, so that's why it's got a little whitish like dip, because this soil is a bit lighter. And this one is from the clay-based soil, so more darker type of soil.
Okay.
That's why it's got the dark.
I see you went two-tone,
Yeah, the volumes are quite limited, so it was easy. We won't do it on the Chardonnay that's close to 50,000-60,000 bottles. Then it becomes a bit of, too much.
Is Chardonnay still your biggest one?
I would say Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, and then the Shiraz. Yeah,
okay.
The Shiraz and Chardonnay blocks are in and almost similar.
This is a lovely Chardonnay.
The Cabernet is actually the vineyard, the biggest vineyard on the farm. That's exactly 3 hectares.
Mm-hmm.
Because way back when I'm only focusing on single vineyard wines, for me it's important to work with a specific site and to really show, so you can actually, each wine's got like an ID. You can track it back exactly from where it's coming.
Totally.
And it's nice to walk like a... these different, you know, through every season from the same block and experiencing that, you know, it's not just a mingled mousse. You kind of really start learning that specific site in terroir. And I mean, when I started, the maximum size of a single vineyard block was 3 hectares. So all my Shiraz, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Chardonnay is 3 hectare vineyards. But the Chardonnay, there's one part that's not growing as well anymore. That's why it's giving a little bit lower tonnage than the Cabernet Sauvignon. And with the Shiraz, I thought good to actually plant 1,000 vines within the Shiraz block to make like how they do in Rhone Valley. And eventually I realized we're in Robertson, not in Rhone. So I was stuck with 1,000 vines and didn't go with the Shiraz because the focus was single varietals. And so with the Shiraz. And we had, in 2000, this vintage, Shiraz as varietal didn't carry a lot of fruit. I mean, it was such a low yield vintage. I mean, I only got like 5.5 tons of a hectare.
That's little.
And the same with the Chardonnay. Chardonnay was also low in yield versus the rest of the varietals.
Yeah. If you would say lazy Sunday lunch, choose one.
What would you choose?
Yeah.
It's difficult. That's not fair.
It's like choosing one child. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'll drink somebody else's wine of my own. And it depends. You know, wine is, there's a time and place for every wine. You know, it depends what the occasion is, what you're feeling for, how much you've had the previous evening. And is it a sunny day or cloudy day?
Okay, so I'll picture it for you, then you need to tell me. Okay, let's say Sunday lunch. It's October, so it's springtime. It's not yet summer. It's actually wine on the river. What would you do if you're down at wine on the river and you would...
Then I'll probably start drinking more Grenache. You know, it's like not a heavy wine. It's a varietal. Sorry. Oh, I'm blessed. I need that.
Yeah.
So Grenache, you know, it's suited for, you can chill it down on a warm summer's day. But it's, for me, just perfect when it's like that changeover from summer to winter.
Yes.
When it's just...
It's very interesting you say that, because I've drank Grenache before, but I've tasted that one time I came to visit here. You gave me a bottle and said, go and taste this, chill it, and then you have it. It was amazing, because I struggle to drink red wine, I'll be honest with you. I love white wine. I love it, love it. And Mad Grenache was fantastic on a... Very hot. Sorry, it's so loud.
You should have pictured like a rainy day.
I know that you're quite outdoorsy as well. You love riding your bike pretty much, and you did the Epic last year.
Yes, last year, definitely not this year.
but tell us, when being in season, busy harvesting, getting to exercise, everything. How do you fit it all in?
No, that's why we still have to see how the 2018 vintage came out. But yeah, basically it was a lifetime opportunity. You just had to work it in somehow. How we've done it, I still don't know. But yeah, it's just, we live in such an amazing place with various little copies and great tracks. And yeah, that's Robertson awesome. For me is an amazing place for running, cycling. And yeah.
I know there's a Java route or something here with
Yes, Van Hoofren. Yes. Philip has, Neil has done quite a bit of effort.
Yes.
There's also Corn for Union, the valley that's...
But they also they also do the epic,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, and they did this year as well, and last year. But yeah, it's just, I think, Robertson as an area, it's so well suited for that.
That's fantastic, yeah. Very nice.
It's also, I mean, the area's got also a lot of great hikes and stuff to do. So.
Yeah, like the wine pockets.
People must come out and see the valley.
Exactly. But on that point, tell us about what are you doing, what events are you doing this year that people can come and enjoy and maybe come to you and come and have a dinner with you or something like that?
No, I mean, now the first event coming up is Wacky Wine.
Yes.
That's now in June, I think, first week of June.
First week of
But I mean, they can obviously visit the website, Arendse's website, everything's on there as well. But then in October, we've got the Wine on the River.
That's my favorite. Yes. I do love it.
And then during the season, we've got Hands on Harvest.
Yes. And also lovely. Then they eat with you around the table and everything like that.
This year, we did like a winemaker's braai at the river. That was
fantastic.
Lekker. And then Robertson Slough. Obviously, when people come out and just enjoy a lazy weekend in the valley.
Okay, awesome.
Also, more experiencing hands-on, with us as
producers and so forth as well.
Farm,
And tell me, and they can find out all of this on your Facebook pages, websites, things like that.
Yeah,
pretty much. Need to follow you. Fantastic, and people can follow you there. I think that pretty much sums it up for this afternoon. I know the rain is coming up quite hard as well, so people can't hear us. But thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's always wonderful being back in Robertson Valley. And we hope to be back again soon.
Thanks, Sybil.
Pleasure.
Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or log into www.nicheradio.co.za.